SBS live streams and podcasts are supported by advertising.
Need a few minutes to reset? Great Minds is a podcast from SBS that guides you through different meditation styles from around the world. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
SBS, a world of difference. You're with NITV Radio, on mobile, online and on radio.
We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land NITV Radio broadcasts from, the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation and their elders past and present. We also acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tribes and clans we broadcast to, from the mountains to the plains, from the desert to the sea, from fresh water to salt water.
Yama, and welcome to NITV Radio. Bertrand Tungandami Ngaya. I am Bertrand Tungandami. Coming up in your program this Monday, the 22nd of April, like every Monday, we'll bring you current affairs stories from an Indigenous perspective shared with us by NITV's NOLA program. Also on NITV Radio today, we have a conversation with Charles Darwin University's Dr. Stephen Roche, explaining how the compulsory income management scheme is doing the opposite of its stated objective, actually doing more harm to First Nations welfare recipients in the Northern Territory. Also in your show today, Indigenous rangers from the River Murray and Mali Country Corporation are working with ecologists to monitor how the environment is responding to the influx of water in the Murray Basin 1 year after the area suffered the most devastating floods in 50 years. All these stories and more coming to you on NITV Radio after the latest news.
Australia Day 1972 saw the first Aboriginal embassy.
The native title legislation must be amended.
And they've walked this land so many times before anybody came.
I am sorry.
This bulletin, Indigenous artists becomes the first Australian to win the prestigious Golden Lion Award at the Venice Biennale. Treasurer Jim Chalmers tells Australians to expect a responsible federal budget. And the opposition leader criticised for not releasing the coalition's nuclear policy. The jury that chose Indigenous artist Archie Moore for one of the world's most prestigious prizes says his work offers a glimmer of hope, as well as acknowledging the loss and pain in First Nations history. The Gamilaroi and Bigambal artist has won the Gold Lion at the 60th Venice Biennale, often called the Olympics of the Art World, for his installation Kith and Kin. The work includes a hand-drawn family tree in chalk, tracing more than 2,400 generations, as well as a floating installation featuring more than 500 documents that reference Indigenous deaths in custody. The International Jury President, Julia Brian Wilson, says the work was chosen for its strong aesthetic and its representation of shared loss.
In this quietly powerful pavilion, Archie Moore worked for months to hand-draw with chalk a monumental First Nations family tree. Thus, 65,000 years of history, both recorded and lost, are inscribed on the dark walls as well as on the ceiling, asking viewers to fill in blanks and take in the inherent fragility of this mournful archive.
Opposition leader Peter Dutton has been criticised for not releasing details for the coalition's nuclear policy. Details for the energy policy were due to be released before the May budget, but Mr. Dutton says he will hold off on announcing the details, partly due to the two recent stabbing incidents in Sydney. The details would include the location and costs of proposed nuclear power stations. Labour MP Mark Tisowait told Sky News that Australians want to see the details.
This is their signature policy, and the Australian people have the right to know what this policy is all about, particularly where the coalition are planning to situate these nuclear power plants.
Treasurer Jim Chalmers says the global economy is fraught and fragile ahead of the government May budget. He listed five key factors behind this unpredictable global outlook, including inflation in North America, slowing growth in China, rising tensions in the Middle East and Eastern Europe, fragmenting supply chains and a transforming global economy. Treasurer Chalmers says the budget will downgrade forecasts for growth in most of the biggest economies. He added that the budget is not expected to return as much revenue as previous budgets and will continue to focus on inflation. Environment Minister Tanya Plibersek says Australians must be kept safe from alarming scenes on social media following the refusal by Company X to remove graphic footage and false theories related to Sydney's recent stabbing attacks. She told Channel 7 ex-owner Elon Musk doesn't dictate to the Australian government around its social media policies. A general strike paused all businesses in the West Bank on Sunday after a two-day Israeli raid in Tulkarem that killed 14 Palestinians. Palestinian health authorities say of the 14 Palestinians killed in the raid on Saturday, two have been identified by Palestinian officials as a gunman and a 16-year-old boy, and it was one of the heaviest casualty tolls in the West Bank in months. Shop owner Jody Nacha spoke following the events.
The budget will have a premium.
The strike is sympathy for our people in the north. It feels difficult to us for every martyr and every child who falls. What's required from us is that we sympathize with our brothers, because believers are brothers. What happened in the north is a little thing in front of what happened in Gaza.
Hundreds of people have marched through Niger's northern city of Agadez to demand the departure of United States troops from the military base there. This comes a day after sources said an agreement had been reached between Niger and U.S. authorities to commence the withdrawal. There were around 1,000 U.S. troops in Niger as of last year, operating out of two bases, including a drone base built in central Niger, at a cost of more than $100 million. The base had been used to target Islamic State militants and an Al-Qaeda affiliate in the Sahel region. Protester Ramatu Usman explains why they are protesting against the U.S. presence.
Our presence is just about the Americans leaving. It's just about the Americans leaving. We want the Americans to leave our town because they've been doing nothing for a few years now and we've seen nothing of them. So we want them to leave our region for good.
And to sport in AFL, the Sydney Swans have delivered a stunning 53-point win over the Gold Coast Suns, kicking 8 consecutive goals across the second half of the game. The game ended 110-57 in a bitter defeat for the Suns, who thrashed Hawthorn by the same margin last week. Tom Papley was the star of the show with 3 goals from 13 touches, setting the over 35,600 strong crowd into a frenzy. Swans star recruit Brody Grundy spoke to Fox Sports reporters after his 200th game.
Look, I remember on my 100th game, I didn't really stop and smell the roses, and obviously there's been a lot that's happened in the last sort of 100, and definitely stopping and smelling these roses, that's for sure.
Now having a look at the weather around the country, Broome mostly sunny, 33, Perth sunny, 30, Adelaide similar forecast, 22 degrees, Melbourne partly cloudy, 18, Hobart mostly sunny, 19, Albury-Wodonga sunny, 23, Canberra partly cloudy, 20, Wollongong showers, 20, Sydney same conditions, 22, Newcastle rain, 21, Brisbane also rainy, 25, Townsville sunny, 28, Cairns partly cloudy, 30, Alice Springs similar forecast, 25, Darwin mostly sunny, 35, and the Torres Strait Islands a sunny day ahead and a top of 30 degrees. And that is NITV Radio News.
NITV Radio, Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 1 p.m. or anytime online.
I'm Bertrand Tungandame, and you're listening to NITV Radio, coming to you from Nam on the Kulin Nation this Monday afternoon. Coming up in your program today, conversation with Charles Darwin University's Dr. Stephen Roche, who will be explaining to us how the compulsory income management scheme is doing the opposite of what its stated objective is, and it's actually doing more harm to First Nations welfare recipients in the Northern Territory. And Indigenous rangers from the River Murray and Mali Country Corporation are working with ecologists to monitor how the environment is responding to the influx of water in the Murray Basin 1 year after the area suffered the most devastating floods in 50 years. But first, like every Monday afternoon, we'll bring you some current affairs stories now from an Indigenous perspective shared with us by NITV's NOLA program.
Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
Victoria's democratically elected First Nations body has told the state's truth-telling inquiry that treaties are crucial to addressing centuries of inequality. As hearings continue into land injustice at the Yurok Justice Commission, attention last week turned to the treaty process due to ramp up later this year. Cameron Gully reports.
It's been a long march to treaty. Members of Victoria's First Peoples Assembly eager to share their work with Yurok.
There can be no treaty without truth.
The day began with a welcome to country and a smoking ceremony at the Commission's rooftop garden before the elected co-chairs appeared to give their evidence.
Invasion and colonisation saw concentrated and sustained attempts to smash our societal structures and eradicate our people. The colonisers' approach to land management pushed our lands to the brink of ruin, and the colonisers exploited country for the highest short-term economic benefit.
The current round of hearings are investigating injustice related to land, skies and waters. They kicked off with a ceremonial hearing on Gunditjmara country last month. The hearings have so far heard of the intergenerational impacts of land dispossession, colonisation, country mismanagement and the denial of wealth from resources.
Today we are faced with a divide between those whose wealth was stolen and those who grew and passed down that stolen wealth. This is what we need to address. This is why we need to negotiate a better, fairer deal for our people through treaty.
With the state's first treaty negotiations anticipated to start sometime later this year, the Assembly reaffirmed that it wanted to be granted extra decision-making powers through negotiations.
We've already identified that our aspirations are that as a result of that, we would then aspire to be a body that would then be able to hold powers as a result of statewide treaty outcomes.
The Yurok Justice Commission hearings will continue into next week, including an on-country hearing with the Premier.
And that was Cameron Gully reporting for NITV News. Now, every year, artists and art lovers from around the globe descend on the Italian city of Venice for the world's most prestigious international art event, the Venice Biennale. And this year, First Nations artist Aki Moore is representing Australia with his exhibition called Keith and Kin. NITV's Ricky Kirby caught up with the artist before he set off to Italy.
From his island home just outside of Brisbane to the canals of Venice.
It's a big privilege and honour to be selected to be the artist for Australia at the next Venice Biennale 2024.
This spectacular work by the Kamilaroi Mbigambul artist fills the Australian pavilion at one of the world's oldest international art events. Rendered in chalk on vast blackboards, Archie Moore has been in Venice since February creating this work. Called Kith and Kin, it features Moore's family tree of First Nations connections.
To try and represent that vast amount of time, tree goes up on all four walls of the Australian Pavilion and onto the ceiling.
Spanning thousands of generations and 65,000 years, piles of historic documents also form part of the installation, confronting the legacy of Australia's colonial history.
We have over 500 reams of documents. Mostly they are coroner reports of Aboriginal deaths in custody. And also with those coroner reports, there's also material from archives that involve both sides of my family.
A reflective pool sits at the centre of the exhibit, evoking the atmosphere of a memorial.
It reflects the family tree, members of my family, as a way to show that the people mentioned in the coroner's reports are not just statistics, but human beings and family.
Archie Moore is only the second solo First Nations artist to represent Australia at the Biennale.
Showing at the Australian Pavilion on the international stage, it's a great way to share with international audiences some of the history of Indigenous Australians.
An artistic spectacle telling an ancient story of kinship and connection. Ricky Kirby, NITV News.
And some Melbourne primary schoolers have had a visit from an AFL legend this week to learn some playground lessons. Eddie Betts treated the excited students to a few episodes of his new kids TV show, and teachers were given some educational resources to help students learn from the program.
Life lessons with a footy great. Eddie Betts teaching these kids about leadership and friendship.
Well, everything I want to do is to teach kids and educate kids, and to even bring out a cartoon series that will be teaching kids to show leadership, self-determination within the playground.
Taking his new NITV TV show, Eddie's Little Homies, to Sacred Heart School in Fitzroy. Betts is hopeful the kids are excited to see a story set in their suburb on the screen.
The cartoon series was based in this community, and you know, these kids can relate to that cartoon series.
I think it's made them feel pretty special to think that their little part of the world is featured in a cartoon series.
The kids thrilled to have such a high-profile visitor coming along for a visit to watch some TV.
They had a ball. They were rapping along and clapping along.
Teachers at the school have also been given some learning resources from the Australian Children's Television Foundation so they can teach the kids some life lessons from the program.
It's really beneficial for the children to be able to sort of see how young people are able to solve problems amongst themselves without necessarily adult intervention. I think sometimes as adults we probably intervene a little bit too often.
It's really important for kids to be able to see themselves and their culture and their friends reflected on screen. I mean, you know, we all deserve that. We all want to see that.
Important lessons for our next generation. Ricky Kirby, NITV News.
And that's all for the stories brought to us by NOLA, NITV program focusing on current affairs from an Indigenous perspective. We must now step aside for a break, but stay with us because when we come back, we look at a government scheme that's achieving the opposite result of its stated objectives, actually creating great harm to First Nations welfare recipients in the Northern Territory, including exacerbating gender-based violence.
You're listening to the radio of NITV.
Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
A new study conducted by members of Charles Darwin University's Faculty of Health alongside Monash University has found that compulsory income management in the Northern Territory is perceived to be ineffective in reducing harm and actually can even contribute to situations of family violence and is incompatible with the needs of welfare recipients. Joining me to discuss this finding is lead author and CDU senior lecturer in professional practice, families and communities, Dr. Stephen Roche. Dr. Roche, thanks for joining us and welcome to NITV Radio.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me and thanks for your interest in this study.
Now, Dr. Roche, before we delve into the findings of your research, can you paint us a picture of a typical recipient of welfare who is subjected to the compulsory income management scheme? I believe the majority of them would be First Nations or welfare recipients in the Northern Territory.
That's right. In the Northern Territory, the vast majority of welfare recipients are First Nations people. And of course, those welfare recipients are located all across the Northern Territory, from urban centres in Darwin to remote and very remote locations. There's currently around 20,000 welfare recipients in the Northern Territory who are subjected to compulsory income management.
Wow, that's quite a big number. Now, your study highlights the perceived ineffectiveness of compulsory income management in reducing harm. Can you elaborate on the main findings regarding its impact on social welfare recipients?
So our study interviewed 26 social services or social sector experts, people involved in managing social services, service delivery, representatives of the Northern Territory government, and the legal and advocacy sectors. All of these people have long-standing insights into the impact of compulsory income management for welfare recipients. What we wanted to know is what they thought about compulsory income management, particularly over time. Compulsory income management's been in the Northern Territory now since 2007. So it's really quite a long-standing approach to social welfare. Our key findings found that compulsory income management was largely viewed as ineffective in achieving the stated policy objectives around reducing social harms and improving the well-being of welfare recipients. There's a number of reasons for this. The first reason really is that the mechanism itself doesn't really change the dynamics of welfare recipients' lives in the way in terms of what they can purchase and buy. And that's because compulsory income management in the form of the basics card, previously the cashless debit card or the smart card, is still a currency that can be used if people want to buy alcohol or they want to gamble, these types of things. They can still use the basics card in various ways. They can trade it. They can. We had reports of being overcharged in a taxi and receiving some cash back, these types of things. So it can be turned into cash relatively readily. Some of the other things that our participants told us were that, you know, it did make life more difficult for welfare recipients a lot of the time, particularly what's called the administrative burden of compulsory income management. So where you need to be engaging with Services Australia or INJU, which is the private company operating the cashless debit card, to be able to manage your financial affairs. And particularly in regional and remote areas, Services Australia and INJU could be really hard to contact. It relied on network coverage. It relied on access to smartphones and apps, things like that. And often Services Australia staff are very hard to engage with face-to-face, less and less available in remote areas. The other thing we found was that in situations where, say, recipients lost their basics card, it would take weeks to get a new one. And that would involve often getting support from other services like family violence services to support them to get those basics cards returned.
Also, one of the significant findings of your research is the link between compulsory income management and situations of family violence. Could you explain how compulsory income management contributes to or even exacerbates issues of family violence?
The first thing to say is that the original logic that compulsory income management could reduce family violence is pretty flawed, because the financial arrangements of families isn't a driver of family violence in and of itself. What we found was, and particularly those participants who are working with family violence services, they said, look, we have a number of clients that we support where they've told us that the basics card and the cashless debit card have been somewhat weaponized in their experiences of family violence around financial coercion and exploitation, and being used really as a way to control women. They gave us some very awful examples of men using the basics card as a kind of weapon to increase their level of power and control over victims, and in some cases, you know, levels of coercion where sexual assault and things like that were threatened. It's certainly not the solution to family violence, compulsory income management. It certainly could argue from our study that it's certainly not helpful.
Now, your research also identified compulsory income management as a top-down approach lacking community consultation. How do you envision a more community-inclusive approach to policy development regarding compulsory income management, and what benefits might such an approach offer?
Well, I think, you know, since the Northern Territory Emergency Response, the intervention where compulsory income management was first implemented in the Northern Territory, many, many studies have found that the design of compulsory income management and its implementation has been top down. And that means that it hasn't engaged with welfare recipients themselves, with community leaders, and even other experts in the field, non-government organizations and the Northern Territory government. And what this means is two things. It means that the design of compulsory income management has been poor, leading to some of these findings that we've found. And it also means that people who are affected by it feel very marginalized. They haven't been involved, they haven't been consulted, and they feel like this policy is being done to them and they're not not in partnership with these types of policies. In future, strong consultation needs to occur with cultural leaders, Aboriginal leaders, elders, and to get their ideas about what types of things, policies, programs could support communities, welfare recipients to lead better lives, and what could actually reduce social harms. Without their input, there's never going to be a policy that solves these challenges.
Now, the scheme has been rolled out predominantly in rural and remote areas. Do you see this scheme being implemented in regional and urban areas as well?
The history of compulsory income management in Australia is quite long now. We've had regional locations subjected to compulsory income management across Australia for many years. So in some places, it's been withdrawn. The cashless debit card's been withdrawn in regional areas, like the Ceduna area, for example. The regional, remote versus urban distinction is interesting. There are different challenges and different ways that income management impacts those welfare recipients. But at the end of the day, compulsory income management looks the same everywhere in that it's paternalistic, it's telling welfare recipients how to spend their money, how to manage their economic lives, when really, if we take a social rights perspective, that would see welfare recipients in charge of their own lives, in charge of their financial affairs, because they can decide best what they need to spend their money on in their day-to-day lives, on their children and their families and so on.
And your study calls for a policy reform agenda involving genuine community consultation. I know you kind of touched on this earlier, but what specific steps do you believe policymakers should really take to address the complexities of compulsory income management in the Northern Territory and better support welfare recipients?
I think you need to start over. You need to think about what the key social harms are across the Northern Territory for welfare recipients and make sure you understand those and then begin consultation with those key stakeholders. For example, are the objectives of compulsory income management really the objectives that we want to see from a government perspective or a societal perspective? But are there other ways that might be more evidence-based? So if compulsory income management is a way of trying to change the level of addiction or alcohol abuse and use, that kind of thing, across society, well, is compulsory income management the best way to achieve that? Most people would argue, actually, addiction's much more complicated, much more complex than what you can and can't spend your income support on. But we do know that there are a range of evidence-based services and supports that can assist to support people's addictions. You know, I think compulsory income management misunderstands social issues, and that's what our participants in our study have been telling us. And the solution is, right from the start, community engagement, finding out what people think the real challenges are, the real issues are, and what can be done from their perspective to make change.
Professor Roche, before I let you go, any closing thoughts?
I think one important thing for people to realise is that now the vast majority of welfare recipients subjected to compulsory income management are located in the Northern Territory. The cashless debit card's been withdrawn in other states and territories across Australia. The vast majority of welfare recipients left on compulsory income management are in the Northern Territory. And there should be questions asked about why that's the case. Why has compulsory income management been withdrawn in Sujuna? Why has it been withdrawn in Bundaberg area? And then why does it still remain in the Northern Territory? This is an important consideration.
Dr. Roach, thank you very much for taking the time to give us some insights into the findings of your study, a study that shows that compulsory income management may be doing more harm than doing good. It's been a great pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much.
We must now step aside for another break, but when we come back, we look at an amazing work being carried out by Indigenous rangers in the Murray Basin.
Your community, your conversation. NITV Radio.
Now, coming up next, our story about First Nations rangers who are doing really quite a tremendous work after the devastating floods that ravaged the Murray Basin about a year ago.
More than a year after flooding put this arid landscape underwater, birds are still enjoying the benefits. During summer last year, only the treetops here were visible. Today, rangers Lucy Sumner and Thomas Kurt are edging around the mud on the side of a lagoon. Indigenous rangers from the River Murray and Mallee Country Corporation are working with ecologists to monitor how the environment is responding to this influx of water. Lucy Sumner is a senior ranger with the group.
To me, it's like entering another dream time, a start of another dream time from here and onwards. You know, I have never seen the redfin for about 20 years, and we used to catch this all the time at the river, Renmark Riverfront. But when we was doing the fish monitoring out here in the back creeks, the redfin was just coming back in abundance. There was callops, there was silver bream, everything, all the little important fishes like the gudgeon and all that, they were all coming back in abundance. And like I said, the redfin I never seen for a while, so it was good to see him back in the river.
It's meant the community can return to cultural practices and eat a diet high in native fish.
That's our usual food source, and that's, you know, is more healthier for us than going to a shop. So the more tucker we can get in, natural tucker from the river, the better for us, our soul, our culture and our spirit.
Thomas Kurt, another ranger, left the area as a teen and it looked very different back then.
When I left, we were in the middle of a drought and it was pretty bad. Like, they'd blocked off all of the lakes. Oh, the Barmer Lake is the one that sits on top of my memory. And it had gotten so bad, it was like 20, 30 metres past the jetty, big cod dying, all of the turtles are dying.
When he came back, there was water everywhere.
I think coming back and seeing everything so green and so much water, that was a bigger difference than to when I'd spent growing up here, because, yeah, all of my childhood, it was a very dry place, like not much water, not much rain at all. And then, yeah, coming back after all of them years and just water like you would not believe. So, growing up with the fishing, growing up, it was pretty depressing, only catching carp and introduced species, whereas now, after the flood, there's a lot more natives, and, yeah, it's good to see the river so healthy. And with the yabbies too, there seems to be a lot more yabbies.
Large stretches of saltbush now populate the floodplains. Lucy Sumner is collecting seeds from a flat-top saltbush species. This saltbush is a favourite foraging food of the eastern region parrot, recognised nationally as vulnerable.
This is their favourite food, these little saltbushes. And after the flood, they've all just come back. So we're hoping that it'll attract the birds in and they'll, over time, they'll make this their sanctuary.
Both rangers are surprised at how many black box trees are germinating here. There's a small forest of seedlings and saplings growing on the Pike floodplains. But to survive, they'll need regular high water events. That's when the water flows above the bank. SBS visited an ancient box woodland nearby by boat at the peak of the flood with tourism operator Tony Charlie. It was the first decent drink for the trees in decades. Tony Charlie runs walking tours through the area.
12 months ago, we were in a boat cruising through this box woodland, and the water level was right up here to my shoulders at the tips of these leaves. What an amazing event. It triggered new life throughout the valley. It's given, it's reinvigorated these box woodlands, the old trees, but it's produced seedling germination, a whole new ground cover across our floodplain, which is the habitat for insects, which is the food for birds.
Vivid greens in the foliage and ground cover show how the water has stimulated an abundance of growth. These low-lying areas in South Australia's Riverland rely on regular flooding, but irrigation in states upstream has meant these floodplains no longer get the water they need. And Mr. Charlie says this flood has shown how much an overbank event can achieve.
And that supported a massive bird breeding event. It supported fish breeding throughout the river valley, and now we're seeing the benefits of that flood. There is life everywhere. There's fish in the river system. But what it's really demonstrated is the value you get from a high river event. And we've got to maintain this environmental watering with water that can get over banks so we can keep triggering this pulse of life, you know, every 2 or 3 years.
Peter Doherty, SBS News.
Visit sbs.com.au/NITV Radio.
Have to end the program. The next edition of NITV Radio will be on Wednesday, and then the following one on Friday with the more stories and news from right across the country. Thank you very much for your company this Monday afternoon. Till next time, bye for now. Yalu.
SBS is Australia's most trusted multilingual broadcaster. Our listeners are loyal, highly engaged, and have supported countless local businesses. We offer advertising packages for businesses of all sizes. Our experienced sales team will guide you through the process of owning a great campaign. Bring your own ad or have our production team make you something in one of our 68 languages. Start the conversation with your new audience today. Email sales@sbs.com.au.